Good morning. This session is celebrating the centenary of Lev Landau, and it was organized by the Forum on History of Physics, and I'm glad to see so many sleepy-looking faces, but at least you're here. And I should tell you that this session is being recorded, will be preserved. And our first speaker is Pierre Hohenberg.
Good morning. So, I think those of us who are presenting, this is kind of an emotional occasion, because for obvious reasons. I think the supreme irony, though, of this moment is that in the 60 years of his life, I don't think there was any public sightings of Lev Landau before 11 o'clock in the morning, at which point this session will be over. So my job, my title is Lev Landau, A View from the West. Since I'm the first speaker, I thought it would be appropriate to give a kind of an overview of Lev Landau as a person and especially as a great figure of the 20th century physics. So this is the outline of my talk. I will begin by just setting up, giving you a very brief précis on his life. And then I'll talk about three important points. First, his scientific achievements, which are the main reason why we celebrate him. But then there are two very important other reasons, which, of course, you all know, the course in theoretical physics, the Landau School and the Landau legacy, which I'll say a few words about, seen from the West. So this is a somewhat pompous or at least official picture. I didn't show the official portrait, which I must say I don't like at all. This is a reasonable likeness. Okay, so this is just the very basic outlines of Landau's 60-year lifespan. He was born in Baku, Azerbaijan, and at age 13, you can see he entered the university in Baku. And then he went to university in Baku and then in Leningrad, where he graduated at age 19. And then for 4 years, he was at the Physico-Technical Institute. But for much of that time, he was able to travel to the West. He actually took two or three trips, one for about, I think, close to a year, mainly to Copenhagen, but also to Zurich, Germany, the UK. And he met most of the great physicists of the time, and especially Niels Bohr and Rudolf Peierls. Then he was appointed in Kharkov, first to the Physico-Technical Institute, and then at the same time at the university. He spent 5 years there, and that's where he really founded the Landau School. He began to acquire students and develop the course in theoretical physics. In 1937, Peter Kapitsa was able to attract him to Moscow, to the Institute for Physical Problems, now known as the Kapitsa Institute for Physical Problems. And that's where he spent the rest of his scientific career. As I note here, the beginnings of that were interrupted by a little over a year in jail. That was apparently a leftover from enemies he had made in Kharkov. He just barely arrived in Moscow, and he went to jail. As many of you probably know, Kapitsa was instrumental in having Landau released from jail after a little over a year by addressing directly Molotov and Stalin. A courageous act in those days. But he spent essentially his whole career, the rest of his career, at the Institute for Physical Problems. And as you know, he suffered a tragic automobile accident in January of 1962, which essentially ended his career and ended most of his life. But he survived until 1968. So he had this this accident at age 54. So from essentially 19 to 54, 35 or so years of an active scientific career. So that's the outline. I list here the main scientific achievements as recorded on his 50th birthday in 1958. He was given two tablets. These are the Ten Commandments, Zapovedi, the Ten Commandments, the tablets of the ten important results. He was the kind of physicist who liked, besides all the talk, he liked to have something very specific that you could put down on a sheet of paper or even carve in stone. And so these are the, by 58, that was chosen by colleagues. I'll say a little more about that. These were colleagues at the, I think, Institute for Experimental and Theoretical Physics. I don't know contribution to this choice the members of the direct Landau school had. Perhaps some of them may tell us. Anyway, these are the 10 great papers that's chosen at that time. He essentially introduced the density matrix at age 19 in his first paper. Then one of his most famous papers, of course, Landau diamagnetism, which was certainly finished in Zurich and Copenhagen and done there. Then there is the famous Landau-Lifshitz dynamics of ferromagnets, where they introduced ferromagnetic resonance, the theory of phase transitions, second-order phase transitions, which we're still, in some sense, living off. A lot of that we're still living off, as you all know. Then a paper on superconductivity, perhaps not so well known. If I took a quiz, I'm not sure everybody could tell me exactly what the intermediate state of superconductors is. Anyway, it's the state of superconductors, of so-called type 1 superconductors in a magnetic field. He developed that. Then there was a paper on the statistical theory of nuclei, which then, of course, nuclear levels, which then, of course, was lots of people lived off and continue to. The most famous paper, the one for which he got the Nobel Prize, 1941, the theory of the superfluidity of helium-4, helium-2 state of the isotope helium-4. Then there's a strange paper that was listed there, Renormalization of Electron Charge in Quantum Electrodynamics with Halatnikov and Abrakosov, which I guess is the only paper here which is not quite right, or is not really right. And in many ways, although it was important at the time, hasn't survived. The theory of Fermi liquid, which we sure are still living off. And then, independently of Sudarshan and others, he, right after the introduction of the idea of non-conservation of parity, he introduced the two-component neutrino. So those are the Ten Commandments. But, of course, many of you might feel that there are some of your favorite papers that didn't get mentioned. So I've listed 10 more. They're not really my idea. They're ones I have taken from a kind of memorial or obituary by Yevgeny Lifshitz. So an additional 10 papers. These are the Ten Commandments at the time. Now, what is the strangest thing about this list in 1958? There's an incredible omission. And that, of course, is number 7C. They thought Landau's most important paper on superconductivity in 1958 was the paper on the intermediate state. Because in 1958, those people at least, didn't realize the incredible profundity of 7C, which of course got somebody a Nobel Prize. But there are other interesting ones. In 1933, he essentially, independent of Nail, introduced the concept of antiferromagnetism in order to explain the magnetic properties of a certain compound. This was not a sort of two sublattice antiferromagnet. This was what we would call a metamagnet, planes, ferromagnetic planes, antiferromagnetically coupled. Then he essentially introduced the idea of a polaron, also in 1933. Then in 1934, the so-called Landau-Plaschek component of Rayleigh scattering from entropy waves, which is very important, dominates at the critical point, for instance. In 1944, the theory of turbulence, it's really the theory of the onset of turbulence. In that paper, strangely, he doesn't mention the fact that already there existed a theory of turbulence by Kolmogorov. He doesn't make the connection. But if you look at the book, then you can more or less understand that he understood the connection. That paper is actually turns out not to be quite right either. The onset of turbulence isn't quite the way he said it. Then there's the famous Landau damping of plasma waves, 1946. The Ginzburg-Landau paper, which not only was incredibly foundational for superconductivity, but there are whole fields of physics which really, I think it's fair to say that Landau and Ginzburg didn't think about, of nonlinear dynamics. And some of us have spent a great part of our lives exploring the so-called complex Ginzburg-Landau equation as a model for chaos, turbulence, pattern formation, and lots of other things. So the dynamics associated. Actually, that dynamics, I didn't list. There's an important 1954 paper of Landau and Halatnikov, which introduced dynamics. And of course, the Ginzburg-Pitiyevsky and Gross-Pitiyevsky, etc. Lots of things came from it. Then there's a hydrodynamic theory of multiple particle production cited by Lifshitz. And then in the late 50s, toward the end of his scientific life, Landau decided that field theory was dead. He said we should accord it all the respects for its burial, and you have to go on to something else. And so these last two papers are kind of an attempt at going beyond field theory. There were corresponding schools of thought, dominant schools of thought at the time in the West, the S-matrix theory and all these analytic properties. That turned out to be wrong also. Field theory had a comeback, big time, and then morphed, of course, into string theory. I can't help but remark on a conversation I had with Ken Wilson in the late 60s, in which he was deploring the fact that people had abandoned field theory. And of course, only a few years later, he was greatly vindicated. And part of the revival of field theory was, of course, had something to do with Ken's own work. Fundamental Properties was essentially his last paper. It appeared in the Pauli Memorial volume. It was trying to come to terms with kind of the mess in fundamental field theory, relativistic field theory, strong interactions, what to do, nothing's working. It's an interesting paper. Okay, so my next, the next point I want to make is, of course, to describe briefly the unbelievable course in theoretical physics. It's 10 volumes, which he wrote, conceived of with his longtime student and partner, Yevgeny Lifshitz. The publication started in 1938 with number 5 and went on. My own, I personally just missed I didn't read Russian at the time. I was in graduate school in the late 50s, and we didn't know about Landau-Lifshitz. I think the first translation came out in maybe 59 or 60, but they sort of went by me. I didn't notice these books until after my own graduate education. But it was just at that time that they were beginning to be known in the West. This is the list of 10. You will notice that there are 3 of them that actually were not written by Landau and Lifshitz in Landau's time. Lifshitz then worked primarily with Lev Pitayevsky and produced those missing volumes and then revisions of all of them. But one of the volumes, the Quantum Electrodynamics, Berit Stetsky, was also a co-author. This is, of course, an incredible legacy, and we have, besides, of course, Landau, we have Lifshitz and Pitayevsky to thank for this. And this is certainly a very big part of the Landau legacy. Okay, then finally, the Landau School. So the Landau School was based on the so famous theoretical minimum. Anybody off the street, no matter who, could come to Landau and say, I want to be a theoretical physicist. I want to work with you. And in principle, that was perfectly fine. He didn't ask for papers or degrees or anything else. But he quickly decided, presumably, that people weren't in the running. And over the years, 43 people passed the theoretical minimum. 43 people, 43 men passed the theoretical minimum. Okay? And here they are. This is the list which I found on the internet. Like most things you find on the internet, it's not quite right. So I checked with Lev, and I hope we have it right now. So it's Kampanets was the first. This is, I don't know exactly where Kharkov stops and Moscow starts. It's somewhere in here, I believe. I think Kolotnikov was already in Moscow. Is that right? Yeah, okay. So the first few were in Kharkov and then all in Moscow. This is an interesting one. I didn't know that Tisa had actually passed the theoretical minimum. And many names, of course, that you recognize. And then a few that not only you don't recognize, but I think Lev told me there are a few that he hardly recognized, doesn't really know what became. But most of them are people that, of course, went on to brilliant careers. And of the 4 subsequent speakers, 3 of them are on that list. So what's interesting, really, once again, like the Ten Commandments, is who's not on the list? I call them the adopted sons. These are people whom we think of as being in the Landau school, but are not on that list. Ginsburg, Ilya Lifshitz, Arkady Migdal, Grybov, and Valery Pokrovsky, who is one of our, who came to Landau when he was, I don't know if he already had his PhD, but in any case, was more advanced. Larkin, Asbel, these are people one thinks of as being part of the Landau school. They're not on the list. Again, these are adopted sons, no daughters. So now the question is, what personal interactions did Landau have with Westerners? Well, in his trip to the West, he met Bohr, Peierls, Dirac, Pauli, many others. When he was a brash 19 and 20-year-old, there are interesting reports about this slightly wild individual who liked to tell people off, and the higher up they were, the more fun he had telling them off. Of those, the two that really stand out, as I think I mentioned before, are Bohr and Peierls. Bohr, he referred to as his teacher. He venerated and worshipped Bohr to an extent which I find really quite surprising, because to me, two more dissimilar physicists one cannot imagine. Bohr, profound, obscure, incomprehensible, and concerned about deep thought, having deep thoughts all the time. Landau, straightforward, amazingly clear. But there was certainly worship, adoration on the part of Landau to Bohr, and I understand that Bohr had tremendous affection and respect for Landau. Peierls was really a buddy. They worked together in the 30s, wrote one or two papers together. Peierls had been to Leningrad, and in fact, he married one of Landau's co-students, Zhenya Kanagiso, who became Zhenya Peierls. And so they were very close, and Peierls went back to the Soviet Union. Then he met Dirac and Pauli and many more. He reported that when he went to Berlin, he met Einstein and tried to explain quantum mechanics to him, but he was too old and didn't understand. I'm told that that's apocryphal, that he just told people that, but it didn't happen. I don't know. Maybe some of our friends will be able to say. I say here, due to the isolation of Soviet society, this is essentially most of the contact that Landau had with Western scientists. There were, of course, visits, but they were quite short. And the only Western scientist that I know about that really spent time in the Soviet Union were Schoenberg and Tiese, who really got to know him. But it was very limited. I know colleagues who met Landau, but very briefly. And there was this is, of course, from our point of view, somewhat of a tragedy. I say here, he never met Fermi, Feynman, Anzager, three of the physicists he probably admired most. And that is, again, sad. So let me say a few words about my own experience. When I completed my PhD, I was completing my PhD in 1961, I was told about a program of exchange between the academies, and I applied for it and got it, and I said I wanted to work with Landau. I didn't know that I might arrive there and get booted out on my behind because he would think that maybe I wasn't up to it. But anyway, I said I'm going to go, and so I prepared to go to the Soviet Union and arrived in September 1962, so I basically missed him by 9 months. But I still went, I was able to go to the Institute for Physical Problems and to meet with and work with the members of the Landau School. At the time, I, of course, worked, in fact, my postdoc advisors were Gorkov and Nabokov. I was working on superconductivity, but I met our speakers and many others, except for Roald Sagdiev, whom I didn't meet at the time, since he wasn't at that institute. My own experience of Landau is therefore that his spirit was still hovering in tremendous ways, but I personally missed him. So I want to end by saying a few words about the scientific legacy. And the way I want to talk about it is to ask, what did he leave us, and what would have happened if he had had kind of a normal scientific life? Bethe and Pyrles, two physicists that are sort of Landau-like, were born, I think, the same year. And Pyrles lived to mid-80s, Bethe lived till 98. And they lived through most of the second half of the 20th century. And one sort of asks, well, what? How does the second half of the 20th century, what does it look like in terms of Landau's legacy? Many of the issues that have dominated physics in the second half of the 20th century really are elaborations, sometimes corrections, to what Landau left us. So I want to ask kind of pointed questions. I hope that some of the subsequent speakers might address them or shed light on them. These aren't questions that you answer. These are questions that you kind of think about. I communicated these questions to my colleagues. Once again, not expecting to find answers, but maybe just some remarks. So here are the questions I have. One is superfluidity and Bose condensation. He objected greatly to the idea that Bose condensation had something to do with helium-2 because it was a liquid. Bose condensation was something that occurred in a gas, etc. Well, we now know that it has a lot to do with it, and there are some people even who think that Bose condensation was kind of discovered in 1995 in quantum gases, whereas, of course, it was understood certainly after Bogolyubov's 47 work, but even from London and Tisa before that, the important role of Bose condensation. In my view, I'm sure that Landau's attitude would have evolved once the importance of Bose condensation for quantum gases was made clear. So the whole idea of non-Fermi liquid behavior, strongly interacting electronic systems, this is all elaborations or corrections to Landau theory, metal insulator transitions. Of course, there was the Mott's work certainly existed. I'd be interested to know whether he noticed it and was what his views were on that. But so much of what dominates modern condensed matter and experimental condensed matter physics has to do with beyond Fermi liquid theory. One question I have is, what about Anderson localization and generally the effect of disorder? What were Landau's ideas about one and two dimensional? I know that Zeldovich says that once he wanted to show Landau some theory he had about one-dimensional metals, and Landau said, when you find a one-dimensional metal, talk to me about it. Until you do, that's not true? Well, that's what Zeldovich says, okay? Anyway, I'm quoting Zeldovich. But certainly the two-dimensional Ising model was something, the Anzager solution of the two-dimensional Ising model was something that he admired greatly. I think that was the one piece of physics that he said, I don't think I could have done this. Everything else, if I thought of it, I would have done it. And then, of course, to what extent did Landau anticipate the monotheory theory of scaling universality and renormalization group elaborations? I know he is quoted as having said that there's no problem that he worked on more in his life than fluctuation effects on phase transitions. So in conclusion, I want to make this slightly insolent statement, and that is that as beneficiaries of his great papers, of the course in theoretical physics, and of this legacy, I want to claim that we are all members, in some sense, of the Landau School. Thank you very much. Okay, so I guess I can answer questions if
questions.
I put
we
Lev.
A lot of people.
Yeah. Oh, wait.
Maybe you can repeat it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very short comment on fluid mechanics published during the Second World War, in 1944.
The book. The date I gave was wrong. Was not the first publication. Is that what you're saying?
1944.
I don't remember what date I gave.
It's correct. It was never translated into English. And later it was split in two parts. Hydrodynamics and theory of elasticity, and was translated. When it was split, one important section was completely missed and never published in English, theory of interfacial tension.
Oh.
And then it was rediscovered much later by Kahn and Hiller in 1950.
Oh, interesting.
I have this book in my
head. I see. So the Kahn and Hilliard theory of interfaces was already in the first
published
first in the fluid dynamics fluid mechanics first volume. Interesting. And right. Right.
In 1999 we interviewed Teller, and he told us that he discussed the Teller effect with Landau, and Landau was very much influential in formulating the theory.
So when was this? When was Jan Teller? Mid-30s?
No?
Mid-30s.
Maybe beginning of 30s.
Oh, so that's when I know he did meet Teller in when he went. Yes, that Teller was said to have discussed the Jan Teller effect when they were formulating it with Landau, and Landau was quite influential in the actual development of the theory. So that must have happened when he was in the West in the early 30s. Yes?
Did Landau have any interaction or collaboration with Andre Sakharov?
Relation between Landau and Sakharov, you may want to say something about that.
I will say it.
Okay, it'll be in Roald Sagier's talk. Yes.
One thing that one often never hears about in connection with the famous books is, did Landau give lectures of his stuff? And secondly, was he a good lecturer?
Yeah.
Was discussed among students?
Right. So maybe some of the subsequent speakers could address that. I know he did lecture. I'm sure in Kharkov, he did lecture at Moscow University. He did have lectures to students. I don't think those were the lectures that are in the course. He also wrote more elementary physics books, but he, as far as I know, he had in mind a whole series for kind of college students, as opposed to these, which are really graduate and postgraduate. So maybe the other speakers can address the question about the impact of his lectures on students.
Okay.
So let me try to make sure I haven't lost lips.